Thank you for joining us here on Shift Shapers, Pole Reversal Radio here on KBBF FM 89.1 out of Calistoga. I'm your host, Daniel Kerbine, and we are on the phone here with Alex Smith, who is the host of the EcoShock radio show, which is all about, and we're going to do a little bit of a prepping here for our listeners, but it's a show that is now broadcast on 54 stations, many of them college stations, public stations, and even a commercial radio station. And it covers the subject of what can we be expecting, just like on Shift Shapers, what can we be expecting from climate change? What are we looking at in terms of, is there growth in store and ahead for the economy? And what's happening? What is this decline of oil after peak oil going to be bringing to us? A lot of speculation about that. And Radio EcoShock, hosted by Alex Smith, is one of those programs where the leading thinkers and authors and educators on these subjects come on the air and talk very freely and candidly about the kinds of things we can be expecting and the kinds of ways that we can be preparing for that. So in many, many ways, Alex Smith, you are definitely a compatriot and a fellow traveler on this road of EcoShock. I'm really delighted to welcome you to Shift Shapers, Pole Reversal Radio. How are you doing today?
Well, it's great to be here. It's great to talk to people in California. I always like that opportunity, and I really enjoy your show.
Well, thank you very much. And by the way, we have a podcast, which I'm sure you've visited. It is at www.blogtalkradio.com. Just look up Shift Shapers when you get there, and you'll be able to find all our podcasts. Our most recent one was last week. We interviewed in the studio Richard Heinberg, who is one of the authors and thinkers on the subject of peak oil, who you have interviewed, Alex. I think you have interviewed him a number of times for your show.
I have indeed. And one of the most interesting, I thought, was about coal. He had an earlier book called Blackout, which is saying basically that when coal runs out, and that may be sooner than we think, there is no substitute, and so it goes dark. Our civilization goes dark. That was the idea behind his book, I would say.
And he calls that blackout. Well, I think this is here's where we start to get to the point of putting a little bit of a advisory, shall we say, out to our listeners. That, and would you like to handle that, Alex?
Well, absolutely, Daniel. I think just like when you watch those drug commercials on the TV news, they always say it's wonderful for you, but and then in little tiny letters in a quiet voice, they say that it may actually cause cancer and kill you. And so,
not going to cause you cancer, but
no, I would say if you're feeling clinically depressed or you have thoughts of ending at all, that probably you should tune out, because we're not going to be talking about happy endings all the time the way Hollywood movies do. And maybe the program isn't suitable for young kids. If you've got somebody under the age of 10 just hanging around while you listen, maybe that's not a good idea, too. Other than that, I think this is the sort of thing adults need to talk about and need to hear.
Well, thank you very much. And another thing, just from the point of view of KBBF Radio, the opinions expressed on this and any of our programs are the opinions of the programmers and their guests, and not necessarily the opinions of KBBF FM, the Bilingual Broadcasting Foundation, or the station. So with that out of the way, let's get on with the opinions. So I want to ask you, Alex Smith, it looks as though there aren't a whole lot of programs that really take a lot of time to look at or really focus the program time on looking at what our real situation is concerning the environment, climate change, some of the things that are just stacking up to confront us as a civilization, and to confront us in, like you were saying, like even in some darker and more troubling ways as we're going forward in the future. There's not a whole lot of shows or stations that are actually doing it. I mean, you've got some stations that are carrying your show, but there aren't too many shows, are there, that are doing this?
Not really, no. I think the media is generally to distract us, to lull us to sleep, to watch something on the couch after you come home tired from work, think some light thoughts. But it could be much more than that. It could be really a communication medium about the problems that we're facing and what the experts who delve into these things have to say when they can speak freely. We only get little sound bites from scientists, or they just say experts think. They don't even quote the names of the people who think these things. It's pretty pitiful, the coverage we've
seen. It's kind of the he said, she said sort of thing, because the minute you hear from somebody like Bill McKibben about what climate change is bringing, then immediately you'll hear from like a Senator Imhoff about how, you know, those people are just flaky. You know, it's pseudoscience, et cetera, et cetera. And so it's kind of like a he said, she said, that the idea of balancing out the coverage is to put on somebody with a totally opposite point of view, which is kind of a very interesting approach these days. But you're not really getting into any depth with it. And one of the things that I've liked about your coverage, and pretty much I have been striving to accomplish that with my shows as well, is to get into some depth with somebody who is an expert on the subject and really get down to what they expect to have happening, what the science is behind it. This is your interview, Alex, so I want to find out here, in your words, what is the purpose and the mission of Radio EcoShock?
That's a tough question. I guess it's to inform people about what we're running into, what the future is that we're developing and that we're painting by the way we live, and how could we make changes to that future in case it comes to a bad ending, which is possible. So we cover the environment, especially climate change. I do a lot of work in climate change. I think that is the major threat to not just the human species, but all species. But I also do cover the energy, peak energy, that kind of thing, the need for energy descent, and occasionally the economy, because we don't know which of these triple threats is going to hit us first.
And how did you get to this point? What brought you to this program format and message? How did that all develop? What were you doing before? Was there a major switch in your approach and format to your show? How'd that come along?
Well, it's been a long time coming. I sort of dropped out in the 70s, went back to the land, lived for 10 years without electricity, growing my own food, kind of a survivalist before there were survivalists. And then became a journalist, a print journalist for many years, and went into research, environmental research for a large environmental group, especially using online databases, that sort of thing. Then I started a net radio station, which ran with automated software for 2.5 years out of my living room, and decided after listening to a lot of green radio that I'd like to do that too, and started my own podcast in 2005. It went to a radio show in 2006, and then just other stations kept picking it up.
You're one of the programmers who learned by doing. You didn't actually go to a broadcast school to do this. You learned it by doing.
That's right. And occasionally there were some rough edges, but I'm getting the hang of it now.
That's how we do things around KBBF.
We bring in people who are interested and are committed to getting a message out and giving them some training and giving them the chance to make all the mistakes and learn for themselves how to go about putting together a program. Just so that the listeners can get an idea of the kind of content that Radio EcoShock has, there's something here about Radio EcoShock is a nonprofit adventure to create a strong voice for the environment. It really doesn't get much stronger than saying, hey, you know what, we got to get going here so that we can survive. And another thing is that you don't run commercials, place cookies, or push junk. You listen anonymously. Nobody gets paid. And you can pass on the programs, rebroadcast them, post them to your blog or website, so long as you give credit to Radio EcoShock. So, you know, the world definitely appreciates that. Some of the stuff that you have in here, though, is like how communities survive disaster, you know. It takes more than money. Don't wait to be saved. Comparing disaster responses around the world. Storms, floods, earthquakes, attack, or employers closing. What are the tools to cope and recover? This came out of one of your 09 broadcasts. And then you had one where you are giving advice on what to actually have around so that you can be prepared for an emergency or some sort of a disaster. Can you tell me a little bit about your vision of what sort of things that could involve?
Well, I think what we have to keep in mind is that large institutions, whether it's the federal government or huge banks, and maybe even large universities, are starting to fail. They're bankrupt. And so that means that local organizations have to be formed and local food growing has to happen, and we have to get back to some local manufacturing or production if we want to have some products around us. But even below that level, as individuals or as families, I think we can do quite a bit with just simple things like learning how to can food, because it's a lot cheaper when the harvest comes out and you can put it away. You don't need electricity to keep it, that kind of thing. I do have a solar panel. It's not that big, but it would provide enough LED lights to keep us going here. We have a wood heat backup with some wood stacked outside. We've always got water around, and frankly, I've got a year's worth of food sitting in the basement, so that if things go really badly, we could keep on going. But I think there's just a lot of skills you could learn how to do winter gardening. We just had a program on that with Elliot Coleman, who grows in New England in the winter without any heat. Yeah, and he's producing some good food there, too. So that's a good tool to learn if you're in a more northern climate. And some people are going to want to think about a plan B, a retreat location, maybe a place where you could go in a camper or to camp and know where the fish are and where the food resources are and some of the people around there. That's another way that some people are going.
So what you're calling it, I believe, is rather than paranoia, you're calling it pronoia. And I'm wondering if that is something that you, is that a term that you coined?
No, I've various people have used that before.
Oh, okay. Because what we
call it around here is envirosurvivalism. And the purpose behind calling it that, envirosurvivalism, is because there's lots of survivalism out there. There's lots of people who are saying, oh, man, the end's coming. And there are people saying we are in the end times. And by the way, you know, like, we don't need to be hit by an asteroid to have something really severe happen. There's plenty that scientists are telling us with climate change, peak oil, and the crippling debt in the economy to give us plenty. There's plenty there to cause any sort of outcomes that are not so good. But there are survivalists who are into their bunkers and their guns and stocking up, to whom it means surviving means hunker down, bunker down, load up on weapons, and just be ready for all the zombies to start coming at you. As Kathy McMahon said in one of the interviews that you had on your podcast, that, oh, this is how it's going to be. But then there are those that are looking at it from the perspective of, hey, you know what? Let's look at realistically what some of these scenarios look like, what sort of time frames they might involve, that you do need to be sure you're getting ready for this. But let's have a look at this. Is hunkering down in a bunker going to actually cause you to survive, or is it actually going to cause you to die because you don't have a community supporting you? Very interesting stuff. So that's why I'm looking at it from the point of view of community and environment survival. What's your take on that?
Well, I think sometimes it breaks down along sexual lines, too, because you'll find out that men tend to say, well, I'm going to get a gun and I'm going to dig a deep hole. And women start to think about, well, how could we be sharing clothes here and maybe cooking together? And I'll bet we could get something going in a community. And I personally favor the latter attitude. I think that's really what's going to keep us going. I've made sure that I know my neighbors and I've talked to them about these things, and it turns out that they're in agreement. And I found that two of my neighbors have like hidden gardens under the power lines. So there's a lot of people who realize that this is a situation. Some of them have gone into shock. That's partly why I call it eco shock. It's almost a medical term where you can't act because you're kind of frozen in your brain. We've got to get past that and then start acting locally and doing a lot of the things that Richard Heinberg has told your listeners about, and a lot of things that are going on in California.
So it's not just understanding that that there are some shocks coming, but it's also about getting past the point of being shocked so that you actually become prepared, and when times of difficulty develop, you're not just paralyzed by in fear and surprise, that it actually can do a lot toward the fear to be prepared, not scared.
I think so, but the real problem, and I have this problem, you have this problem, is time frames. How long are things going to take to devolve, or if we're going to have a crash, when does that come? And people were predicting that the whole economy would crash in 2008 and you and I wouldn't even be able to go to a bank or drive a car. That didn't happen. They just kept dancing and rearranging things and making new things up at the top levels, making money out of nothing. So, you know, it could go on for a long time. We look at how Rome fell. It took a couple of hundred years for Rome to collapse. So things on an economic front could go slowly and bumpy and things fall apart, but they keep on going kind of thing. And I would say the same about fossil fuels, we think we're going to run out of one thing, and then somebody finds the tar sands or they find out fracking works. There's new or offshore drilling, or next they'll be drilling in the Arctic. They can come up with new sources of fossil fuels for a while. Jeff Rubens, the CIBC former chief economist, he says it's not, and peak oil is not really about production, but it's based on price. When does it become too expensive for us to just keep the civilization going? That's one thing. And then climate change. We think it's going to be a slow process over decades as it reveals itself. So it could be that you and I will be quite old, but our children will experience it in the worst ways. We think that's what's going to happen. But there are a few scientists who are saying, actually, when we look through the long time record, we find that climate can shift quite a bit within a 10-year period or even a 4-year period. It can go up 3-4 degrees. Now, there are several factors out there that could make that happen, whether it's methane rising up out of the Arctic or the tropical peat fires. There are several things that could take climate change beyond human control of any kind and make it happen quite quickly. If that happens, then the people in the bunkers are going to find that the skills they actually need are how to migrate and how to sort of hunt as you move, because unless you're living near an ocean, which you are, that will modify those sort of heat waves quite a bit, you get the sort of situation that they had in Moscow in 2010 where, you know, thousands of people died of the heat.
Is that amazing?
We only think about the Russian winter and everybody freezing, and here's a city famous for its cold winters where people are dying in the heat.
Yeah, well, and 20,000-30,000 died in Europe in 2003 from the heat. They weren't prepared at all. And there were a lot of social factors in that to do with holidays and old people and no air conditioning and just never experienced heat like that before. They didn't know what to do. So, you know, we look at these time frames, and it could be that you and I will live out bumpy lives with a lot of difficulties, but the next generation will have an extreme challenge, which could even include a large die-off of people.
That is the part that we, I like to try and skirt that part of the message, but I'm glad that you're confronting it, because most of the literature that we read, like in particular, you know, some of the, like the Long Emergency by James Howard Kunstler, is, he's very frank about this. And a number of other speakers and authors and thinkers are becoming very frank about this, that any number of these factors, like you said, the extreme heat, climate change, eradicating entire fields of food for entire countries, that escalating price of fuel and how it's going to get distributed, who knows? So any of these can cause, you know, we see the results of these things are death. I mean, there was death in Pakistan from the floods, and we saw a number of deaths in the United States with just with Hurricane Irene, which was not a huge hurricane, but it was a very unexpected volume of rainwater from a hurricane in areas that hadn't experienced something like that ever. So, yes. I'm just underscoring what you're saying, and it's the piece that is kind of like hard to say, but that really does need to be said, which is that we're talking about phenomena that, as they play out, could be producing and probably will be producing death.
Well, you know, geneticists tell us that sometime between 70 and 100,000 years ago, there was a real bottleneck for humanity, where our population shrank dramatically, possibly to between 10 and 20,000 humans. That's all there were on the Earth at one point in that period, according to what our genes tell us now. And so that, you can look up the Toba catastrophe theory as one explanation for what happened there. A big volcano exploded in Indonesia, and they think there might have been 5 years where there was such a cloud of dust that the light couldn't get through, and most of the plant life died off. And, of course, we depend on plant life. So that has happened before, and yet humans survived. And that's what Dr. James Lovelock is talking about in The Revenge of Gaia. He says, if you let climate go all the way, we burn all the fossil fuels, and then nature kicks in with the positive feedback events, what happens is you end up with a small number of humans gathered around the polar sea, which is the only place cool enough for mammals like ourselves that have this internal temperature gauge to live and survive. So that's the horrible future we want to avoid. We're not doing a good job so far. The Durban Climate Conference was a total failure as far as protecting us. So, you know, we're not making any progress yet. We're actually having a big party, emitting even more CO2 into the atmosphere last year than ever before.
Yes, and I see. And you're located in Vancouver, in Canada, and I see that Canada has finally seen the light and has joined the U.S. in its commitment to remain a major polluter and not change anything with no change in sight. It's really difficult to envision the world suddenly turning around on this course when you see, like the island nations, when we see what's actually happening. When we see island nations, they're getting the salt intrusion from the rising sea levels, and they're actually losing their islands. And these are nations that have only been nations about 30 years, and that's going to be like the beginning and the end of them is about a 35, 40-year period as a nation, not because of revolution, but because of the environment. And you have we had in the state of Texas 3 million acres of land burnt to a crisp last summer. You know, every once in a while I read the list of climate disasters that occurred just in the United States. There's at least 11 really major ones, and it's really something to look at that. I mean, I'm kind of getting off on this describing it, but you have provided a number of those lists and tallies on your show, and I'm hearing you say that it could be gradual. I'm also getting an inkling that maybe there could very well easily be something, some sudden things. Is that what you're saying too?
It's possible. We live in such a fragile system. Everything's just-in-time delivery. You know, if you have a flood in Thailand, then you can't get enough hard drives because those factories are flooded, and suddenly Intel has to say that they're going to have a big loss and their stock goes way down. That's how fast it happens. That just happened a couple of months ago. So, and there used to be big food warehouses in every city where they distributed the food out, but those are gone now. The warehouses are the trucks rolling along. That's what Walmart instituted and other companies have followed. So if those trucks stop running, the food stops coming into town, it doesn't take very much. Or, for example, if a couple of satellites go out and you can't get your Visa or debit card to work, people will start to starve. Because that's how fragile it is right now. So it wouldn't take much.
Yeah, it wouldn't take much under this current circumstance.
Because here we are without any alternatives built in.
Well, we've gotten rid of all the alternatives, and we've made a very fragile economy that depends totally on fossil fuels. And, you know, that's not a good design. When NASA built something to go to the moon, for every device, there was a second mechanical backup device that you could call on. And that's the way we should have built our society, but we didn't do it.
And, you know, there are some dedicated thinkers on this subject, and not all of them that I agree with. There's James Lovelock, who has written the books about Gaia. Now, where I am just totally moved and inspired by his writing is on his description of Gaia, you know, the surface of the Earth as an organism. That is beautiful. That is a thing of beauty, his description of that. And I have to say, personally, he goes on to this development of the theory that one of the ways out for protecting climate is widespread use of nuclear power, and that, hey, what's the difference? We're all going to die of cancer anyway. It'll be a worse death to have all these climate events happen. That's how dedicated he is to that we really need to do stuff about this, and we don't have a lot of alternatives open to us other than things like nuclear power. And then I look at Fukushima, which is still, you know, it's still emitting suds of nuclear waste out into the ocean and who knows where else. And there were two nuclear plants that were endangered in the Midwest during the flooding of the Missouri River. Two nuclear plants that nearly got flooded out and had a Fukushima-type disaster there. So really, it seems as though if we go that route,
climate change events could actually take those plants out just through the severity of flooding and things of that nature.
Absolutely. Plus, some of the French nuclear power plants, for example, are built on rivers, and they depend on a lot of river water to cool them off. And during their heat event in 2003, they had to close some of those plants down because they couldn't get enough river water, or the river water was too hot. So there's a lot of reasons why nuclear just doesn't work. And even if we say, okay, we totally believe in nuclear power, we don't care if we all get irradiated, we're going to build them, there's nobody to finance them. There's nobody to insure them. No private company would dream of insuring. Look what happened at Fukushima. And then you get to the point where you say, okay, we're still going to do it by some dictatorial government or something. So we're going to start building a nuclear power plant a day. We still couldn't make it in time to replace the amounts of energy that we're using right now. It just isn't going to happen. So the people that are pushing that realize that there's no new nuclear power plants being built in the United States, and we're just keeping the old ones going longer and longer, way past their design level. It's only a matter of time till we have a bad accident in the United States, I think.
And in California, we have the added benefit of being on earthquake fault lines. And actually, many other parts of the United States and the world are coming to that realization as well. Who would have expected an earthquake in Virginia?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I've done a couple of programs on California nuclear plants, and there's problems.
Mm-hmm. It would be great if you're ever in Northern California in the San Francisco area, I would love it to have you come in the studio. We could spend an hour easily on this subject. It's great to be talking to a kindred spirit in the world of broadcast and in getting information out. And I'm wondering, is there any advice that you would have for people who are maybe, whether they're in the information business or maybe just in talking to other people they know, there's got to be people who are thinking, you know, this isn't working. I mean, I don't see a good end to all this. Start looking at the economy and climate change and about any number of things. What sort of thing would you say to them? I mean, I'm not saying, you know, about even a hopeful word, but just, you know, how do you deal with this? And do you go be just honest with people and say, you know what, here's my view of what I think is going on, keep it to yourself, or go out and what are some thoughts you might have on that? You know, things people can do and say.
I definitely think people need to communicate about this, and that we can all do that. We've got this fantastic machine available to us through Twitter and Facebook and your blogs and your websites. We're all communicating all the time, so we need to get this into the flow. And to put a bit of a hopeful note, there are cases in nature where whole populations wheel about at one time. We've seen it with birds in the sky and schools of fish, and there have been waves of human change as well. And to stimulate them, I think we have to pass on this kind of information. So I recommend that people take just a couple of hours that they spend watching television, watching Dancing with the Stars or whatever it is. I know none of your audience listens or watches that, but for those who have their secret little getaways on television, spend at least 1 hour a day, maybe two, to find programs like yours and mine and just pass them around, to figure out ways to make CDs of them and pass those out, to get public meetings going on for discussion, to get a transition town going where you live. That's really important, transition towns. Look it up, Rob Hopkins' basic idea. To get to meet your neighbors, to have maybe some neighborhood dinners or community dinners to talk about it, to think about getting community gardens going so that we can feed ourselves if times get tough. To donate your time to the community to help those people who are just have been unemployed for 2 years and they're out of money. All of those things are community building and will help you personally have more control over your life and perhaps do better if we run into problems.
That is really well said. Alex Smith of Radio EcoShock. I'm going to give a couple of locations to find out more about Radio EcoShock EcoShock. On the internet, it's www.ecoshock.org. That's ecoshock.org. And there is, is there anything else that people need to know as far as how to find the EcoShock Radio? Are there other sites? Is there another blog site? What do you have to add there, Alex?
Yes, from that main site, you can click on our blog, but some people go there directly. For every show, we have a blog that has all the links that go with it, and some of those are kind of interesting to follow up on. So that's at ecoshock.info.
That's great. And you're listening to Shift Shapers on KBBF FM 89.1. You can also find this interview, along with others, our podcast, at www.blogtalkradio.com. Look for Shift Shapers. And also, we have a blog as well. It's www.shiftshaper.blogspot.com. So we put our opinions on various things at that site. So you can find Shift Shapers there. So there are some resources, folks, for you to be able to be taking a hard look at the future and look for ways. If you're looking for hope, the hope is going to be it's like one of the books on survival says, you know, the key to survival is not necessarily what's in your pack, although make sure you have a good pack with preparations. It's what's in your heart. So get informed, get courageous, and we'll just walk into the future. Alex Smith, Radio EcoShock, thank you for joining.
Thank you so much, Daniel. It's been a pleasure.